A moment of triumph. For Dr. Fauci, the FDA licensure was a moment for exaltation. After years of humiliation and failure, with his critics pounding him against the ropes, he finally had something to show. A double-blind, placebo-controlled study of 3,200 people, which allegedly showed that AIDS patients receiving AZT survived at rates exponentially higher than those denied the treatment. Dr. Fauci now had a product that validated his clinical trial system. At this first whiff of AZT's success, even before his AZT study was published, the young technocrat seized the moment to do what he always did best. He called a press conference. 2 years later, Dr. Fauci would reminisce about those halcyon days. When I first got involved in AIDS research, I was reluctant to deal with the press. I thought it was not dignified. There is, in fact, little evidence of that reticence in the public record. From the outset, Tony Fauci seemed almost desperate for such indignities. Dr. Fauci launched his media blitz with an unprecedented action. At 10 o'clock in the morning, following his evening receipt of the initial study results, Dr. Fauci began personally calling key journalists to announce his triumph. No director of an NIH institute had ever contacted the press like that, says Nussbaum. Traditionally, the NIH director himself made major announcements, but Dr. Fauci was apparently unwilling to share the glory with his nominal boss, NIH Director James Weingarten, or with HHS Secretary Otis Bowen. In making his proclamation, Dr. Fauci employed the gimmick that he watched Robert Gallo pioneer during his premature announcement of Gallo's study linking HIV to AIDS. That announcement had shattered another tradition. Historically, agencies didn't announce the results of clinical trials until the data were peer-reviewed and published so that journalists and the scientific community could read the study and reach their own conclusion about what the science said. Gallo had trailblazed the technique of science by press release 4 years earlier, when he had staged an HHS press event to announce that the probable cause of AIDS had been found, a retrovirus that would later be named the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. The press reported Gallo's discovery as scientific fact, even though Gallo had not published a peer-reviewed paper supporting his enormously consequential assertion. Here was a useful innovation that allowed regulatory officials to craft and control the public narrative from inception. The science was what the regulators declared it to be. There could be no opportunity for journalists to read the ambiguous data, consider contrary expert opinion, or second-guess official pronouncements. Dr. Fauci made himself the virtuoso of this technique, displaying it at its apogee during his April 28, 2020 announcement of remdesivir's miraculous performance during NIAID's rigged and fraud-tainted clinical trials while seated on an Oval Office couch beside President Trump. He had no peer-reviewed or published study, no authentic placebo trial, no data, and not even a handout for the press. With this vague hearsay claim, he forced through emergency use authorization for his darling drug and sold Gilead's entire inventory to the president without publishing a word or ever leaving the sofa. Under Dr. Fauci's leadership, this practice would become a routine vehicle for extreme abuse in the COVID-19 era, when vaccine companies habitually disclosed cherry-picked highlights of their clinical trials in press releases weeks before publishing far less bullish study results. Those tactics drew criticism as pump-and-dump enterprises, with company executives simultaneously unloading stock timed with deceptive announcements that drove up share prices. At least one case, Dr. Fauci's Moderna vaccine, prompted a federal securities investigation. Using the same extravagant language he would later apply to remdesivir, Dr. Fauci boasted to reporters that his trial had produced clear-cut evidence that AZT saved lives. Any reporter who wanted to cover the story for the evening news had to take his word for it. And then, as now, some people simply couldn't conceive that Anthony Fauci would lie or exaggerate. Dr. Fauci giddily declared that his agency would recommend AZT not only for individuals with full-blown AIDS, but for asymptomatic people who had tested positive for HIV but showed no signs of AIDS. He never mentioned that AZT cost $10,000 for annual treatment, only that Burroughs Wellcome would sell it for $500 a bottle. The FDA approval meant the taxpayers would subsidize AZT's costs. Burroughs Wellcome's shares soared 45% on Dr. Fauci's announcement, adding £1.4 billion to the company's UK stock market value in one day. The company's CEO predicted that AZT profits would bring in over $2 billion per year. The PIs had handed NIAID its first successful drug trial. Dr. Fauci was now in the clear, and he knew that the PIs had pulled his chestnuts from the fire. Not only had they given him a blockbuster AIDS drug, they had also built him a tried and tested system for producing future drug approvals. He no longer needed to pander to the CRI doctors. Dr. Fauci wasted no time in putting an end to his parallel track charade. When Dr. Fauci abandoned the CRI system, NIAID just as quickly lost its brief interest in patient care or in testing repurposed new drugs against the opportunistic infections that killed people with AIDS. NIAID went back to its comfortable niche, nurturing pharmaceutical blockbusters. It was the same old story, recounts Nussbaum. Nothing had changed for years. There was only one problem. Dr. Fauci's entire clinical trial for AZT had been an elaborate fraud. A moment of truth, uncovering the fraud. In July 1987, the New England Journal of Medicine finally published Burroughs Wellcome's official report on the Phase II AZT trials, the so-called Fischel study, which was the basis of the FDA's approval of AZT. Outside scientists finally had the chance to scrutinize the study's details for the first time. Many had earlier expressed shock at its abbreviated duration, but now they began to uncover evidence of fatal methodological flaws, some attributable to confirmation bias, but others clearly the product of corruption and deliberate falsification. Within days, reporters, researchers, and scientists began lobbing aspersions on Dr. Fauci's Pollyanna-ish and self-serving interpretation of the data. European scientists complained that NIAID's raw data showed no benefit of reducing symptoms, a finding that threatened Glaxo's biggest anticipated profit pool. The Swiss newspaper Weltwoch termed his AZT trials a gigantic botch-up. Investigative journalist and market research analyst John Lauritsen, who had covered the AIDS crisis since 1985, became the first intrepid journalist to critically analyze the details of the AZT trials. When he saw the NEJM reports, he quickly realized that the research was invalid. In his first AZT article, AZT on Trial, October 19, 1987, he wrote, "The description of methodology was incomplete and incoherent. Not a single table was acceptable according to statistical standards. Indeed, not a single table made sense. In particular, the first report on efficacy was marred by contradictions, illogic, and special pleading." He telephoned the nominal authors of the report, Dr. Margaret Fischel and Douglas Richman, and spoke to each for half an hour. Neither one of them could explain the tables in the reports that they themselves had allegedly written. They could only say that he should call Burroughs Wellcome for answers to his questions. The New York Native published Lauritsen's reports beginning in 1987. These reports later appeared in two books, Poison by Prescription, The AZT Story, Poison, 1990, and the AIDS War, Propaganda, Profiteering, and Genocide from the Medical Industrial Complex, TAW, 1993. 18 months after AZT's approval, FDA conducted its own investigation of the study. For many months, the FDA, cowering before Fauci's bullying, kept its damning reports secret. The most shocking revelations about Dr. Fauci's systemic conduct would emerge after Lauritsen finally obtained some 500 pages from the FDA investigators' trove of documents using the Freedom of Information Act. Those papers clearly demonstrated that the Fauci-Burroughs-Wellcome research teams had engaged in widespread data tampering, which some have viewed rose to the level of homicidal criminality. These documents showed that the double-blind, placebo-controlled trials had become unblinded almost immediately, which alone rendered them invalid. Internal FDA communications with the research team revealed rampant falsification of data, sloppiness, and departure from accepted procedures. In one of the Freedom of Information Act (FOIA) documents, Harvey Chernoff, the FDA analyst who reviewed the pharmacology data, recommended that AZT should not be approved. Chernoff noted many serious toxicities of AZT, especially its effect on the blood. Although the dose varied, anemia was noted in all species, including man, in which the drug has been tested. Chernoff further noted that AZT is likely to cause cancer. AZT induces a positive response in the cell transformation assay and is therefore presumed to be a potential carcinogen. The phase 2 trials were supposed to last for 24 weeks, but Wellcome and Dr. Fauci aborted them at the halfway point. The investigators claimed that AZT was miraculously prolonging the lives of those taking it. Lauritsen analyzed the mortality data and concluded that they were certainly false. Although few patients finished the full 24 weeks of treatment, and 24 lasted less than 4 weeks on the drug, the investigators analyzed the skimpy data anyway, using bizarre statistical projections to forecast the probability of a patient's experiencing various opportunistic infections if the trials had continued as planned. Lauritsen scathingly comments, "This is analogous to estimating the probability of developing arthritis by the age of 70, using a sample in which only a few people had reached this age and in which some were still teenagers." Most seriously, FDA investigators found a great many instances of cheating in the Boston Center where they began their review. Dr. Fauci's decision to terminate the trials prevented the inspectors from investigating the other 11 centers, which were presumably just as dreadful as Boston. After agonizing over whether to exclude data from the delinquent Boston Center or from patients with protocol violations, the FDA decided to exclude nothing. False data were retained. Garbage was thrown in with the good stuff. The FDA argued that if all the false data were excluded, there would be an insufficient number of patients left to complete the trials. Lauritsen pointed out that FDA's knowing use of false data constituted fraud. In 1991, 4 years later, Lauritsen filed a Freedom of Information request asking for various FDA documents pertaining to the Phase 2 AZT trials. Most importantly, the Establishment Inspection Report on the Boston Center, written by FDA investigator Patricia Spitzig. After months of lies, evasions, and obstructions from the FDA, a courageous female FDA whistleblower breached all the stonewalling and saw to it that Lauritsen got the Spitzig report. It was a bombshell. As it turned out, the Boston principal investigators, PIs, cheated on almost every patient. The Burroughs-Wellcome PIs had quickly realized that AZT was so reliably deadly that they were hard-pressed to keep the trial recruits alive for the full 6-month study. The Boston team solved this dilemma by lying about the length of time patients were in the trials. The company incentivized this sort of fraud by paying its PIs according to how many months they kept the AZT trial subjects alive. Simply put, says Lauritsen, the doctors received a great deal more money from longer-term enrollments. Pharma PIs know that their careers and paychecks depend on their ability to consistently produce study outcomes that will win FDA approval for the subject drug. Such perverse incentives naturally drive research bias, confirmation bias, data tampering, strategic laziness, and deliberate falsification and cheating. PIs routinely covered up adverse events, violated protocols, falsely reported AZT patients as being placebo patients, and lost control of the test product. FDA based its AZT approval on case report forms, CRFs, filed by Burroughs Wellcome PIs, who each had compelling financial and career inducements to downplay injuries to achieve a successful trial. However, there were also reams of shocking information in the medical records of private physicians, hospitals, and the diaries of patients that contradicted the crisis. In virtually every patient, the FDA's Spitzig found serious discrepancies between the medical records and what the PIs had entered on their CRFs. The rules of the trials clearly stated that the PIs must record all adverse reactions on their CRFs and report immediately to the FDA. The Boston PIs did neither. The FDA documents showed that the PIs knew very well which patients were on AZT and which on placebo, that they were skewing safety results in AZT's favor to give advantage to the AZT participants. Researchers began by placing the sickest patients in the placebo group. The researchers then bent over backward to coddle the group that took AZT, giving them more supportive medical services than the placebo subjects. For example, individuals taking AZT during the 4-month study received 6 times more blood transfusions than the placebo group. Of those who got AZT, all suffered from its unspeakable toxicity. A number of them would very definitely have died from anemia had the PIs not given the blood transfusions to keep them alive, says Lauritsen. AZT causes anemia in every animal species ever studied, including human beings. In his book, Poisoned by Prescription, Lauritsen explains how patients taking AZT became anemic and suffered low white blood cell counts accompanied by vomiting. FDA's documents showed that everyone in the AZT group suffered severe toxicities and anemia, yet NIAID's official report listed no adverse effects among AZT recipients. Some of the AZT patients suffered adverse reactions so deadly that they needed multiple blood transfusions just to keep them alive. Dr. Fauci's crooked researchers pumped these individuals with regular blood transfusions and then neglected to record their multiplicity of health problems. In the AZT group, 30 patients, over half the total, clung to life until the end of the study, only with help from multiple blood transfusions. In each case, the Boston PIs checked no adverse reactions on the CRFs. Some 20% received multiple transfusions. In the placebo group, on the other hand, only 5 patients received transfusions. What happens when you get a blood transfusion, asks noted AIDS researcher and author Dr. Robert E. Wilner, MD, PhD. You look better, you feel better, and you live a little bit longer. But the most important question and lesson from all of this, you must ask the question, why do those on AZT need 6 times more transfusions in a 4-month period than the individuals on the placebo? Because you're dealing with a killer drug. Many of the patients would have died from the toxicities of AZT if they had not been given emergency blood transfusions, reports Lauritsen. This is a serious adverse effect. That means literally that they would have died from the poison. And yet the case report forms that showed up eventually would report no adverse effects. I mean, This is a type of dishonesty. It's hard to go any further than that. Dr. Wilner, who died in 1995, accused Dr. Fauci of using transfusions and other artifices to systematically conceal AZT's horrendous toxicity. What do we have to say about the National Institutes of Health when a private independent laboratory found AZT to be 1,000 times more toxic than the laboratory of the NIH? We can understand a 5% error in a laboratory, even a 10% error, but a 10,000% error or a 100,000% error? That's fraud. One typically appalling item in Spitzig's report concerned patient 1009, who was already taking AZT and was therefore ineligible to participate in the clinical trial. The Boston PIs nevertheless illegally entered him in the study and assigned him to the placebo group, although he never stopped taking AZT. He suffered typical AZT toxicities, including severe headaches and anemia, dropped out of the study after less than a month, and died 2 months later. The PIs counted him as a death in the placebo group. Lauritsen wrote, "Further comment would be superfluous. If this is not fraud, the word has no meaning." Even in that innocent era, the United States mainstream media heavily censored journalistic criticism of Dr. Fauci and the corruption in the AZT studies. Most Americans were therefore unaware of any dissent from the AIDS orthodoxy. This was less true in Europe and the UK. On February 12, 1992, Channel 4 television in London broadcast a documentary, AZT, Cause for Concern. Produced by Meditel, the film described the material from the FOIA documents, exposed the crooked AZT trials as rank fraud, and chronicled the terrible toxicities of the drug. The next day, the charity, Wellcome Foundation, divested itself of most of its stock in Wellcome Pharmaceuticals, the parent company of Burroughs Wellcome, the manufacturer of AZT. Burroughs Wellcome stocks plunged, and the company suffered a series of hostile takeovers by SmithKline Beecham and then by Glaxo. Millions around the world viewed the UK documentary, but neither it nor any of the medical AIDS critical documentaries have ever been broadcast in the U.S. AZT is the most toxic drug ever approved for long-term use. Molecular biologist Professor Peter Duisberg has explained AZT's mechanism of action. It is a random terminator of DNA synthesis, the life process itself. Dr. Joseph Sonneben stated simply, AZT is incompatible with life. On January 27, 1988, NBC News broke the censorship blockade to broadcast the first of reporter Perry Peltz's three-part expose on the AZT Fischel trial. Peltz reported additional evidence of widespread tampering with the rules and the pervasive cheating, which she discovered had started on day one. Peltz learned that Fauci's claim that the study was double-blind was a wholesale canard and reported that most volunteers knew who was on the drug and who wasn't. Since everyone was desperate for the miracle drug, the volunteers on AZT admitted to sharing their drug with placebo group members. This practice assured that researchers would get no clean results from either cohort. Furthermore, Peltz learned both placebo and study subjects were taking other drug regimens they obtained by purchasing remedies from buyers' clubs. Peltz was practicing understatement when she branded NIAID's AZT experiments as seriously flawed. Dr. Fauci loves the media spotlight, but only when the pitcher is throwing softballs. Peltz closed her report with a pointed comment. When preparing this report, we repeatedly tried to interview Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institutes of Health. But both Dr. Fauci and Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Frank Young declined our request for interviews. When Lauritsen saw the NBC broadcast, he commented, "Welcome to the club, Perry." Fauci also refused to speak to the BBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation Radio, Channel 4 Television London, Italian Television, The New Scientist, and Jack Anderson. All these outlets had expressed skepticism about the official report. Of course, Dr. Fauci remained a constant presence on the more obeisant media outlets. Despite years of ineptitude and catastrophe, he has managed to survive by cultivating credulous journalists who do not ask critical questions and give him free rein to broadcast self-serving propaganda. Furthermore, he had already become a master at persuading media outlets against giving platforms to his critics, a technique that served him well in 2020 and 2021. By September of 2021, Dr. Fauci's power to muzzle his critics had achieved a mastery over free expression unprecedented in human history. That month, with a single phrase, Dr. Fauci silenced pop icon Nicki Minaj after she questioned whether COVID vaccines might be causing problems involving testicular swelling. When CNN's Jake Tapper asked him about Minaj's claim, Dr. Fauci simply declared, "The answer to that, Jake, is a resounding no." As usual, he cited no study to support this assertion. The vaccine manufacturers acknowledge that the products are not tested for effects on fertility. Nevertheless, based upon Dr. Fauci's word alone, Twitter immediately evicted Minaj from its platform, censoring her communication with her 22 million followers. Pharma's obedient attack dogs, CNN, CBS, and NBC, rushed on to the dog pile to defame and discredit the rapper and to assure the public that Minaj was wrong. Dr. Fauci, after all, had spoken. On February 19, 1988, Dr. Fauci appeared with hosts Charles Gibson and Joan London on ABC's flagship television program, Good Morning America. His appearance was part of a propaganda blitz of the friendly media platforms to resurrect himself and AZT from the all-out assault by scientists and independent reporters like Lauritsen and Peltz. Initially, GMA invited Dr. Fauci's most vocal and credible nemesis, perhaps the world's leading virologist, Berkeley professor Dr. Peter Duisberg, to appear on its show. Duisberg, who had at that date received more NIH grants than any other scientist, was enraging his benefactor agency by claiming that AZT was not just worthless, it was killing more people than AIDS. Duisberg had flown across the country to appear. On the evening before his scheduled appearance, GMA's producer called Dr. Duisberg in his Manhattan hotel room to inform him that the show had been canceled. The following morning, Duisberg awoke to watch Dr. Fauci promoting AZT and defending his study on GMA unchallenged. This was, by then, a common motif for Dr. Fauci. His gift at strong-arming obsequious, slavish, credulous reporters to silence critics and to shield him from debate. The fawning GMA hosts asked Dr. Fauci why only one drug, AZT, had been made available. He replied, "The reason why only one drug has been made available, AZT, is because it's the only drug that has been shown in scientifically controlled trials to be safe and effective." The sycophantic GMA team, characteristically, accepted Dr. Fauci's statement as gospel. Almost all of Dr. Fauci's claims in that broadcast were lies. Lauritsen points out that this brief statement contains several outstanding falsehoods. First, there have been no scientifically controlled trials of AZT. To refer to the FDA-conducted AZT trials as scientifically controlled is equivalent to referring to garbage as la haute cuisine. Second, AZT is not safe. It is a highly toxic drug. The FDA analyst who reviewed the toxicology data on AZT recommended that it should not be approved. Third, AZT is not known objectively to be effective for anything, except perhaps for destroying bone marrow. Only 33 years later did Dr. Fauci finally concede that AZT's performance in his ballyhooed clinical trials, ostensibly saving lives at a 19-to-1 ratio, was actually less than stellar. Ironically, his delayed confession arrived just as Dr. Fauci was minting a new whopper. In May 2020, during the White House meeting where he pronounced the miraculous efficacy of Gilead's antiviral remdesivir, another beneficiary of Dr. Fauci's manipulations, he admitted the first randomized placebo-controlled trial with AZT turned out to give an effect that was modest. That's not what he said at the time. In 1987, he claimed that AZT was 95% effective. 19 had died in the placebo group, and only one in the AZT group. In 2020, based on equally flimsy and contrived evidence, he made similar claims for his lethal remedy, remdesivir, and his dubious Moderna vaccine. The media's reportage of AZT in the late 1980s almost universally lamented the cruelty of AZT's astronomical costs that ranged from $8,000 to $12,000, not counting the cost of the required blood transfusions when patients' platelets plummeted. Anthony Fauci solved this problem by making AZT standard of care for otherwise healthy people with no AIDS symptoms who nevertheless were diagnosed with HIV via PCR tests. In 1989, when Dr. Fauci recommended universal testing, the LA Times dutifully gushed that AZT could benefit about 600,000 of the estimated 1.5 million HIV-positive people in the country. Dr. Fauci promised these healthy Americans that taking AZT could delay their inevitable death sentences and would have the broadest impact of any of the therapeutic advances shown in recent years to prolong the lives of patients with AIDS or HIV infection. The New York Times' Philip J. Hiltz uncritically reported that everyone should now get tested. Dr. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said that now people who are at risk for AIDS, even if they have absolutely no symptoms, it behooves them to get themselves tested. The resultant flood of additional customers clamoring for the drug significantly expanded the AZT market, allowing Burroughs Wellcome, now GlaxoSmithKline, to lower per-unit costs. No mainstream media outlet told the public about the behind-closed-doors meetings where FDA green-lighted Dr. Fauci's sketchy new initiative. The meeting's transcripts reveal the deep anxieties of the FDA panelists, who worried that they had no idea if AZT might actually help healthy people, or whether it may perhaps kill them. Among all the American journalists covering the AIDS beat, only Celia Farber showed curiosity about the particulars of this milestone debate. In 1989, she quoted from the FDA transcript in an article titled Sins of Omission in Spin. Everybody was worried about this one. To approve AZT, said Ellen Cooper, an FDA director, would represent a significant and potentially dangerous departure from our normal toxicology requirements. One doctor on the panel, Calvin Kunin, summed up their dilemma. On the one hand, he said, to deny a drug which decreases mortality in a population such as this would be inappropriate. On the other hand, to use this drug widely for areas where efficacy has not been demonstrated with a potentially toxic agent might be disastrous. We do not know what will happen a year from now, said panel chairman Dr. Itzhak Brook. The data is just too premature, and the statistics are not really well done. The drug could actually be detrimental. A little later, he said he was also struck by the facts that AZT does not stop deaths. Even those who were switched to AZT still kept dying. I agree with you, answered another panel member. There are so many unknowns, Once the drug is approved, there is no telling how it could be abused. There's no going back. By invoking the people are dying argument to rush through AZT's licensing for healthy Americans, the FDA's drug approval process was decimated. Farber told me the idea that complying with the normal safeguards of the regulatory process and taking time to prudently study a drug for safety or efficacy was artfully conflated with murder. In that sense, an unbroken devolution of FDA's regulatory function leads from AZT to the fraud-fueled emergency use approvals of remdesivir and the Moderna mRNA vaccine during the COVID pandemic. The death blow to FDA's safety function was AZT, says Farber. After that, any potentially deadly disease became an excuse for curtailing clinical trials. Death by medication was normalized as an inherent part of progress. All those poisoned Americans were just unfortunate casualties in little Napoleon's noble war against the germs. Dr. Fauci's fraud persuaded hundreds of thousands of people to take AZT. For many of them, it was a lethal choice. In 1987, AZT became the AIDS therapy, even though in the recommended dosage of 1,500 milligrams a day, it was absolutely fatal. Throughout the 1980s, the average lifespan of a patient on AZT was 4 years. The life expectancy only began to increase in 1990 when the FDA lowered the recommended dosages from 1,200 milligrams a day to 600. The quality of life on AZT was universally pretty miserable. Many credible scientists argued that AZT was killing more people than AIDS. Lauritsen estimated that AZT killed 330,000 gay men between 1987 and 2019. Many of the dead were perfectly healthy before beginning the AIDS regimen. Absent AZT, Lauritsen said, the vast majority of those men would not have died. Fast Track Template. AZT's record-setting race to approval did not stand for long. By 1991, Dr. Fauci had effectively abandoned testing low-profit repurposed drugs in the Parallel Track CRI program. But he used a parallel track to open a loophole in the FDA drug approval system, a loophole large enough to drive through truckloads of pharma's new high-profit patented antivirals. Using CRI's relaxed rules, Dr. Fauci and his pharma partners shattered a series of new speed records at FDA. Still smarting from the public roasting Dr. Fauci had administered to them, bedraggled and bullied FDA officials lowered agency standards to green light Dr. Fauci's dark pharmacopoeia of deadly chemotherapy drugs with minimal safety testing. That year, exploiting the regulatory breach he had created with CRI's fast-track system, Dr. Fauci waved through another DNA chain antiretroviral terminator drug to quick approval, allowing it to skip the double-blind placebo testing he had previously declared indispensable. NIH had developed and patented didanosine before licensing it to Bristol-Myers Squibb. Didanosine won FDA approval without even a pretense of a placebo-controlled study. The drug had so many debilitating and lethal side effects that FDA, in an uncharacteristic act of civil disobedience against NIAID's diminutive dictator, issued a black box warning. Nevertheless, desperate HIV-infected Americans rushed like doomed lemmings to take the drug. In 2010, FDA issued a statement that didanosine can cause potentially a fatal liver disease called non-cirrhotic portal hypertension. Even with its demonstrated toxicity, Dr. Fauci used CRI parallel track process to bypass the usual controls to win approval for use of didanosine in pregnant mothers who test positive for HIV. A 2019 study found that didanosine accounted for 16% of prescriptions for infected mothers and 30% of the cancers in their children. In 1996, Dr. Fauci used his expedited fast track to break another record by winning FDA approval for Merck's HIV antiviral Crixivan. This time it took only 6 weeks. Dr. Fauci achieved that feat by allowing Merck to run Crixivan through a skeleton CRI process on a tiny cohort of 97 volunteers in 3 groups, thereby winning the swiftest approval in history, 42 days. That approval prompted open revolt by the AIDS community, which felt betrayed when Merck hiked up the price of the drug. Activists led by the Treatment Action Group condemned Merck's misuse of the CRI exemptions to secure approval for its deadly and ineffective drug. In 2016, Dr. Fauci boasted that his efforts had led to the approval of some 30 new drugs to treat HIV/AIDS. Dr. Fauci called this extraordinary accomplishment one of the most important transformative discoveries in biological sciences. These drugs generated billions of dollars in revenue for drug makers. In 2000, global revenue from AIDS remedies was $4 billion. By 2004, it jumped to $6.6 billion. In 2010, AIDS drugs cracked the $9 billion mark for pharmaceutical giants and topped $30 billion in 2020. On the surface of AIDS, what the public sees is a benevolent exterior devoted to saving lives of originally mostly gay men in the West, then, since they shifted the narrative, primarily Africans. A global apparatus now worth over $2 trillion and composed of more NGOs, more organizations than anybody could count, obliterates all dissent, all real language, history, and truth, says Celia Farber, author of Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS. It's a beast system, and Fauci created it. It's not capitalism at all. It detests merit, standards, and all the values of Western civilization. It uses the violence of the woke economy to recast lies as truth and to proudly crush and block any and all dissenting voices. It does this always in the name of saving lives. Only now, with COVID, are Americans able to see Fauci's cold, ruthless face behind the mask. Americans have tried to follow what that man has said for a year and a half now, and we who have been dealing with him for so long, we feel like, welcome to our nightmare. Nothing he says makes sense, yet nobody stands over him to rein him in. Tower of Babel. Americans are trying to make him into a benign figure, but more and more they feel a sinking feeling. Is he a madman? Why can't we understand what he is actually saying, what he means? This is very unsettling when people are as afraid as people are now, since COVID. Aftermath. A key and enduring legacy of the AZT battle was Dr. Fauci's emergence as the alpha wolf of HHS. His enormous budget and multiplying contacts on Capitol Hill, the White House, and the medical industry thereafter allowed him to influence or ignore a succession of politically appointed HHS directors and to bully, manipulate, and dominate HHS's other sister agencies, most notably FDA. In his biography of Dr. Fauci, author Terry Michael described the drug approval system that NIAID nurtured post-AZT. What has evolved into the HIV/AIDS industry is supported by a knowledge monopoly comprised of federal government bureaucratic authorities led by Dr. Anthony Fauci, who hands out billions of dollars in research grants, who collude with crony capitalists from international pharmaceutical cartels, who distribute billions to AIDS advocacy nonprofits, and whose official stories are communicated to the public by a science-illiterate mass media. With few exceptions, it is a media populated by journalists who don't even attempt to understand the science. These journalistic interpreters of those they label scientists are pawns in the hands of authorities in long-sleeved white laboratory coats. That chief authority about HIV/AIDS, Dr. Fauci, has tightly held the purse strings on all HIV/AIDS research since he was appointed head of the NIAID in November 1984. As Michael suggests, the unique skill sets that allowed Dr. Fauci's extraordinary longevity and continuing public credibility, despite his miserable record of preventing and managing chronic and infectious disease, were his gifts for weaponizing media relationships, magically deploying journalists to promote his self-serving narratives, and relentlessly silence dissent. Dissent was effectively shut down in mass-mediated public discourse, Michaels observes, and it was scrubbed from peer-reviewed science and medical journals, which reap significant revenue from drug company advertisements for antiretroviral drugs. Journal revenue is also derived from expensive annual subscriptions purchased with funds from tens of thousands of HIV/AIDS-related grants funded by U.S. taxpayers, if approved by Anthony Fauci. Template. His success at using the AIDS crisis to bring a deadly, toxic, and ineffective AIDS drug to market taught Dr. Fauci some key career lessons that he would faithfully repeat again and again and again throughout his long regime. During his battle to win FDA approval for AZT, Dr. Fauci pioneered the strategies upon which he would build his career and then showcase for the world during the COVID epidemic. These include pumping up pandemic fears to lay the groundwork for larger budgets and greater powers, incriminating an elusive pathogen, fanning hysteria by exaggerating disease transmissibility, periodically stoking waning fear levels by warning of mutant superstrains and future surges, suggesting substantial changes in how people live, ostensibly to save their lives, keeping the public and politicians engaged through confusing and contradictory pronouncements, using faulty PCR and antibody tests, and manipulating epidemiology to inflate non-verifiable case and death numbers to maximize the perception of an imminent calamity, ignoring and dismissing effective off-the-shelf therapeutic remedies, directing energy and money toward profitable new patented drugs and vaccines, championing dangerous and ineffective drugs originating in government laboratories as the only winning solution to end the pandemic, funding and orchestrating confirmation-biased research to validate his chosen remedy, partnering with large pharmaceutical companies and giving his partners advantages in the race for approval, allowing preferred companies to skip key testing metrics, curtailing clinical trials to conceal severe safety and efficacy problems, sabotaging, discrediting, and sweeping aside more effective therapies, antiretrovirals, off-the-shelf remedies, and non-patentable medicines that might compete with his new patented antiretrovirals and vaccines, subjecting competitive products to efficacy and safety studies that are designed to fail, allowing thousands of sick patients to suffer and die by denying them access to demonstrably effective competitive remedies, by publicly protesting the existing remedies were not subject to randomized placebo testing, controlling the key independent committees, DSMB, VRBPAC, ACIP, that approve and mandate new drugs by populating them with his own hand-picked PIs, presenting these agencies as independent and trustworthy experts, using the emergency use authorization to fast-track the concoctions through a rigged approval process to market, using official government propaganda to market his concoctions, employing science by press release to control narratives, making exaggerated claims for the efficacy of his products, using pervious and ineffective post-marketing surveillance systems to conceal mass injuries and deaths from the public, papering over all these testing deficiencies by crafting and promoting enduring narratives about the benefits, safety, and efficacy, citing leading experts to promote hypotheses that are practically never scientifically verified with peer-reviewed studies or appropriate controls, allowing pharmaceutical companies to charge Medicare, government programs, and insurance companies inflated prices bearing no relationships to cost, ensuring that research funding is restricted to projects supporting the dogma, excluding research into alternative hypotheses, preventing debate and censoring dissenting voices in popular media, social media, and scientific publications, and promising ultimate salvation with vaccines. In addition, Dr. Fauci honed the skill of always speaking with authority, even when making contradictory assertions with no scientific basis, to rapidly reshape all government pronouncements into dogma, efficiently perpetuated in a quasi-religious manner by the media. By repeatedly using these formulas for 50 years, Fauci directed his agency away from its core responsibility: basic research on infectious, allergic, and autoimmune diseases that have become epidemic since he took over NIAID and transformed his agency into a profit-making appendage for itself and for Big Pharma. Mark Twain once observed that it's easier to fool people than to convince them that they have been fooled. AIDS activist Christine Maggiore lamented this feature of human gullibility when she assessed the mendacious 50-year travesty of corrupted public health research that Tony Fauci put in motion during the 1984 AIDS crisis. Commercial interests are definitely part of the problem here, and it's also our collective inability or challenge to say, all this time, all these years, all these lives, all these billions and billions of dollars, can we just stop a second and go back to the very beginning and make sure we got this right? I mean, that is so hard to do. People don't even know it's a lie. It's not so much a lie as business as usual. Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments and notes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook.